So play, by definition, is always you're always figuring out what to do. You're always solving problems in play. You're creating your own activity. You're solving your own problems. And play is the most creative thing that children do. And so if you take play away from children, they're always just doing what adults are telling them to do. Then of course they're not going to learn that they can figure out how to do things. They've been raised to do what they're being told to do. They've been raised to think they're being good children if they do what they're told to do. And unfortunately, you know, at the same time that we're in a world where we need creative people and we need innovators more than ever before, because all the straightforward jobs that don't require creativity and innovation have been taken over by robots and computers, right? So we need people who can solve problems that nobody else has solved, or and can even think of new problems, new ways of looking at something. We also need people who have social skills. That hasn't been replaced by computers and robots yet. We need people who have moral values. But those are not the things that can be taught in school. And school is suppressing all of those things instead of allowing them to happen.
That's Peter Gray, professor, researcher, TEDx speaker, and author. Dr. Gray's TEDx speech, The Decline of Play, has reached over 500,000 downloads, and his book, Free to Learn, has touched the lives of thousands of families around the world. Dr. Gray's concept of free play and his in-depth research on a child's ability to learn and grow have changed how families and academics alike view modern education. So take a seat by the fire as we travel to Massachusetts to speak with Peter about giving our children the freedom to learn. I'd like to welcome Dr. Gray. How are you?
I'm fine. Nice to be here.
Thank you. We really appreciate you coming on and spending time with us. So the way we usually start this is we have you introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your research as well and what it is that you do.
All right. Well, I'm a research professor in the psychology department at Boston College. My background is very much in biology and the biology of behavior. For many years, I was doing neuroscience research, looking at the binding of hormones in the brains of rats and mice. But then quite some years ago, when my own son was rebelling in school, I got interested in education, originally for a very personal and practical reason. He was refusing to go to school or making such a nuisance of himself deliberately at school that they didn't want him there either. So what were we going to do? And so we searched for an alternative for him. We found this radically alternative school called the Sudbury Valley School, and where children learn through their own efforts, where there are no courses even offered, although if a child asks for help learning something, the staff members would help. But it is so different from what we usually think of as school that I was concerned what's going to happen with his life if he continues on here. He was very happy here, and I was happy that he was happy. But was he going to be able to make a living? You know, I didn't want him living in my basement all his life. His mom might have thought that was okay, but dads generally object to that more than moms, in my experience. So So I ended up doing a study of the graduates of that school, and that really changed my career. And since then, I've been interested in how children learn when they learn through their own efforts, their own curiosity, their own playfulness, their own biological drives to educate themselves, is the way I would put it now. And that also very much led me to a study of play. So that's how I got started in this realm of research. And since then, I've, among other things, I've written a book based partly on my research and very much also on other people's research, called Freedom to Learn, which is about how children naturally learn, and especially about how they learn through play. I've conducted a number of different kinds of studies to understand better how how children learn, and especially what they learn through play, and really to understand what play really is, you know. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from.
We found you through your book, and it was recommended to us by somebody. So we got it and reread it, and we had started homeschooling about 2 years ago, and you know, that was a big leap of faith for us to start doing that. But once we read your book, to take that next step to give those kids more freedom, like, your book really just opened our minds up to what was possible with education. Your book was fascinating. Some of the stuff that you talked about in there was coming from the public school system. It wasn't really anything that we had thought about before. And that was a big reason we wanted to have you on. I read it, and then Anita here read it as well. And some of the concepts that came out of that were really life-changing for us.
I feel like the reason why I love it is because the way that my brain works is kind of the same in that I need to know the facts. Like, I need to know what does it look like on the other side? Just how you said that. When you said that, and I've heard you in past interviews, I was like, that's exactly how I felt. Like, I just need that reassurance because that's the way that my mind works. And to have the research backed behind it was just so reassuring. And which is another reason why we wanted you on, because we just know that there's so many parents out there that are so fearful in letting go of what we think learning is. And we all have to go through this de-schooling process. And I feel like your studies, your research, and your book all help parents in that de-schooling process.
Yeah, I'm very much like you in that respect. Some people say they just intuitively understand all this. I don't. I have to. I need the evidence.
Yes.
That was even a thought on, you know, when we started homeschooling too. It's, you know, I think it's natural that you say to yourself, well, this is great. The kids seem to love it, but what's it going to look like in 10, 15 years?
Right.
And
that's
the scary part. And your book definitely helps with that, because it's not just somebody who you can read, you can talk to other people who homeschooled, and that's great that it worked for them, but that's one instance. But with your book, it showed us that you did research over, you know, a bunch of different children that had gone to this school, and that it worked. They ended up being successful adults,
right?
Happy adults.
Right.
Speaking of your book, one of the concepts that we love the most and subjects that we love the most was the idea of the hunter-gatherer societies and how they learned and were educated, the children in these societies. We want you to talk a little bit about what the significance is in our present culture and our children compared to the hunter-gatherer societies.
Right, right. Well, so of course, my initial study really was in our society, and the observation that children playing and exploring and following their own interests became educated by any meaningful definition of education. They, you know, I define education as whatever it is that you learn that helps you to live a meaningful and satisfying life. So I don't equate it exactly with learning. We can learn bad habits. We can learn stuff that's trivia and is completely useless. But I define education as all those things that we learn that are useful in our life. And so somehow the children at that school, even though they weren't going through what we think of what the society calls education, which is equated with schooling, they were, by my definition, and I think it's really the only reasonable definition, becoming educated. And so that led me to do further research on what the kids are doing at the school, and they're not, you know, they're doing what you think you would expect kids to do when they're free. You know, they're not sitting down and studying textbooks on their own initiative. That anybody who expects that is going to be very disappointed. they're playing, they're exploring, they're hanging out, they're talking to one another, they're goofing off, they're doing stuff that they're getting into trouble sometimes. You know, they're doing just what you think would kids would be doing. And somehow they're becoming educated through that. They're acquiring the kinds of skills, the kinds of knowledge and skills that are valuable for them to live in their society. And so I kind of developed a biological theory of education about the drives that are involved in education. I come from a biological background, and I think about human behavior from an evolutionary perspective. So, you know, we've been human beings for hundreds of thousands of years. We've been cultural animals for hundreds of thousands of years. What that means is that every generation, for hundreds of thousands of years, every generation of new children has got to become educated. We are the educative animal. We have to, in order to survive and thrive, we have to learn those skills and ideas and values and mores that are important to our culture. And that's been going, that's not new. Schools are new. Schools have only been around for about 120 years or so for most of us. But education is not new. And so this all led me to think, well, how does this all play out? How would this have all played out way back during most of our evolutionary history? Now, of course, during most of our evolutionary history, we were all hunter-gatherers. We have only had, agriculture has only been around for about 10 or 11,000 years, even at the extreme. And that was only in certain parts of the world. So our basic human biology was formed well before agriculture ever came about. It was formed during hunter-gatherer times. So then it becomes interesting, well, how do hunter-gatherer children become educated? So you can see how from a biological perspective, that would be a natural question. And that might also help for understanding the nature of these instincts that children come into the world with. And so with the help of a graduate student, I conducted a survey of anthropologists who had studied hunter-gatherer cultures. It's interesting that as recently as the middle and even into the late 20th century, it was still possible for anthropologists to trek out into isolated parts of the world and find people still living in a hunter-gatherer way of life, pretty much in pristine hunter-gatherer way of life. You know, the period of time from about 1950 to about 1980 was a big time for this kind of research. They would go out and make contact with people who had had very little contact with what we call civilization. So they would go out and study these people, and it turned out that two or three dozen different such cultures in different parts of the world have been studied quite thoroughly. And so we identified 10 different anthropologists who among them had observed and studied seven different hunter-gatherer cultures on three different continents. We wanted a variety. And we asked them questions about children's lives in the cultures that we observed, about the relationship between adults and children. And one thing I should say is that even though these people are living in different climates, some are in jungles, some are in deserts, some are in cold climates, some are in more of them are in hot climates. There's a certain commonality to the way they live. These societies are also called band societies because they live in small bands of about 20 to 50 people per band, including children. And each band is autonomous, and the bands make their decisions by consensus. There's no chief, there's no big man. It's a mistake to call them tribes, because tribes we generally think of as larger groups that are headed by a chief, and also tribes tend to be warlike. Tribes came about later on. But these are band hunter-gatherer cultures, and not all, but many anthropologists believe that this was probably the primary way that human beings were living during most of human history. So another term for these cultures is egalitarian cultures, because in every single one of these band cultures that has been studied, there's no status. There's no, as I said, there's no chief, there's no hierarchy of power. These are the only societies that ever been found that there's no hierarchy of power. Generally speaking, men and women are equal, although some of them tell me that just like everywhere, men tend to do more of the talking when they're having a formal meeting and the women have difficulty getting their voice in. So that's, maybe that's a biological tendency, I don't know. But at any rate, there's not in any formal way, unlike the farming cultures that followed, where men were clearly the masters of the house and men owned the property and women were in some sense the property of the men. That's not true in hunter-gatherer cultures. And what's very interesting is not only is there equality between men and women and among people, but there is very really real equality between children and adults. The part of the egalitarian ethos in hunter-gatherer cultures is that you don't tell other people what to do. That sounds really strange. It sounds even kind of, in our culture, that sounds really weird. Why wouldn't you tell other people what to do? If you know better what to do than they do, why wouldn't you tell them? And from their perspective, the reason you wouldn't tell them is because if you do that, you're kind of acting like a big shot. You're kind of acting like you know more than they do. You're better than they are. You might in some subtle way let them know a different way to do it, but you wouldn't just come right out and tell them to do this. You know, if somebody's using an axe wrong and you want to help them use an axe better, you wouldn't go over and say, hey, you're using that axe wrong, you know, but you might go and do some chopping with an axe yourself in sight of the other person so that they could see what you're doing. You know, even today, I appreciate it when people do that. I hate to be told that I'm doing something wrong. You know, it's insulting, right? And so not only do they behave this way towards adults, but they behave this way towards children. They don't tell children what to do. They don't tell children, they don't give orders to their children. Interestingly, they don't have this concept that we have in our culture that adults in any sense own their children. The children are not in any sense the property of the parents. And in fact, you know, this really plays itself out. Children are in some sense the children, even though their own parents are kind of special in many ways, but they're in another sense the children of the whole band. And all the band cares for the children. The whole band does. And if, you know, kids will freely, even little kids will freely move from one hut to another. If their own parents are having a squabble and it's uncomfortable in that hut, they'll go stay in some other hut.
Wow.
And if, which is very, very rare, they have parents who are in some sense abusive to them, they will go and live with another family. They simply won't stay with those abusive parents. And children are even known to be free to go from one band to another, to move to a whole different band from even where their parents live. So children have basic freedoms that children in our culture don't have. So the other part of this is if you don't tell children what to do, what are they going to do? Just like I said at Sudbury Valley, they're going to act like kids. They're going to play. They're going to explore. They're going to get into trouble. They're going to hang out. They're going to talk to one another. They're going to sometimes take naps on the hammock. They're going to, you know, this is what they do. And so one of the questions that I asked of the anthropologist was, in the group that you studied, how much time every day did the children have for free play? And basically every one of these anthropologists said all the time, from dawn to dusk. You know, maybe they would be asked to do some little chore like carry some wood or bring some water into the camp, but even then, it wasn't an order. It was just kind of a request. And if they didn't do it, that was fine. Somebody else would do it. Very little, if any, actual productive work is expected of children and even of adolescents. So what I'm calling children are those who are from about age 4 on through kind of the mid to late teenage years, basically what we think of as the school age kids in our society today. Kids under age 4 are still kind of regarded as infants, and they may still be nursing. They may be nursing up until the age of 3 or 4. They still are, and they're considered, although they are beginning to explore and they're developing just like kids everywhere do. But the general belief is that with kids who are about under 4 years old, is they kind of need to be watched by adults. They don't have what one anthropologist said that the people in the band would have said, they don't have common sense yet. But at age 4, they've got common sense. By about age 4, they have common sense.
Wow.
Now, we don't even think teenagers have common sense. Right. And sometimes we wonder whether we ourselves have common sense. But
right.
But they believe that by age 4, or roughly speaking, kids have common sense. And it's interesting that this is the way their experience is, because there's actually a certain amount of psychological research that verifies that. There's a shift in children's thinking and children's ability to keep rules in mind and the children's ability to control themselves and be safe that's around age 4. This is according to the age when they've internalized language well enough that they can think in terms of words, they can remember things that were said to them, and they can sort of talk to themselves, which is what we call verbal thinking, so that they can say, all right, so there's a snake. What do I know about snakes? This could be a dangerous snake, and so I better not pick it up. Whereas a three-year-old might just see the snake and go and pick it up, right? Mm-hmm. So they believe that. So by the age of 4, the kids are off. They're playing off, often well away from adults, but usually in age-mixed kids. So the older kids are looking out for the younger kids as they play. One of the questions I asked was, so they're spending huge amounts of time playing. What are they playing at? And with each of the cultures that I looked at, once you made the list of things they played at, it matched reasonably well onto the things that you would have to learn to be a successful adult in that culture. So in every one of these cultures, the boys played endlessly at hunting and tracking game. And, if it was a culture that hunted with bows and arrows, they would be shooting little bows and arrows at first at butterflies and then at toads, and then they'd become very skilled. And they would be, tracking is an extremely difficult skill, and they would play all kinds of games of tracking. They would track one another. They would track their parents. There's no such thing as privacy in a hunter-gatherer culture because everybody can track you. They know where you've been. So they would play these games, and they would also play games and the girls as well as the boys would play games that involved identifying edible crops, finding them. They would play at building huts. They would play, if it's a culture that built dugout canoes, they would play at building dugout canoes. They would play the musical instruments of the culture. They would play at the art of the culture. They would play at the dances of the culture. So basically, they are teaching themselves the skills that are important to their culture, as well as the skills that are important to human beings everywhere. And so you could predict to some degree what they would be playing at the differences from one culture to another, depending on what they had to learn in that culture. So it led me to kind of conclude that children come into the world biologically designed to look around, to see what people do, and especially to see what the successful people do in the world that you're growing up in, and to incorporate that into your play and to become good at it. And that fit very much with my observations at the Sudbury Valley School, where, of course, in our culture differs from a hunter-gatherer culture in that there's way more ways of making a living than there is in a hunter-gatherer culture. You can, in a hunter-gatherer culture, you're a hunter or a gatherer. Most often you're both,
right,
to some degree. And it depends on the culture. In some cultures, men do all the hunting, but in some cultures, women also hunt. Some hunter-gatherer cultures, women also hunt. But everybody gathers. everybody's involved in building huts. And in some cultures, women do most of the fishing, for example. And so to some degree, what the children played at is sex specific. They would play at the kinds of skills that they saw that the adults of their own gender played at. But they often played together, and it wasn't rigorously. I mean, there would always be some girls who would want to play at hunting and gathering, hunting and so on. So at any rate, that's what the observation was. And so in our culture, at a place like the Sudbury Valley School or at in any kind of setting where children are educating themselves, it's important that at least some set of the skills that are generally important to the culture be represented in a way that is real to the child. So a child isn't going to learn how to read if nobody reads in their world. A child isn't going to learn how to calculate with numbers if they're growing up in a world with no numbers and nobody's adding up numbers or multiplying them or figuring out percentages and so on. But if they're growing up in a world where those things are happening, they will learn those things.
So there needs to be some form of exposure to it, right?
In order, there needs to be some sort of exposure to it. So what this means is, if you are a parent concerned about your child's education, you know, it's important that you not raise your child in a closet, right? Important that your child be exposed to the world. Now, with little children, you know, the home has a lot to explore and to learn from. But as children get a little bit older, they kind of need to expand beyond that. No matter how wonderful their parents are only a limited part of the world. And so they want to learn from other adults. They want to learn from other kids, and especially from other kids. They want to find out about the world. As children go older, their horizon needs to expand. And within our culture, within a hunter-gatherer culture, there's not so many different choices. I would say hunter-gatherer cultures have to learn every bit as much as kids do in our culture, but there's more similarity between them in what they have to learn. Whereas in our culture, there's millions of different ways to make a living. There's an infinite amount of knowledge and skills, and nobody can learn any but a smidgen of it. And so, but nevertheless, you want to have enough of exposure so they can dabble and try things and discover what they really like to do. And then they can hone in, if they're the kind of person who likes to hone in, on the kinds of things that they most like to do and become skilled at it.
I think that's so important that you brought that part up, because that was my thought. I'm like, okay, well, so this is, you know, worked for the hunter-gatherer societies for this long, but like you said, their world is only, there's only so many different ways of living in that society.
Right.
Yeah. My thought would be, well, what about us? There are so many ways, and how does a kid not get lost in all of this? And to make sure, I guess, as a parent, you worry, did I expose them enough to everything? But it works, because I guess if you have enough variety, like you said, they'll find their niche somewhere.
I think that's exactly right. As long as, you know, it's also easier today than ever before for kids to find things. You know, we've got this amazing thing called a computer, you know, and kids are very good at figuring out how to use it, and they can find whatever information they want. They can find YouTubes, they can find all kinds of sources of information and knowledge. So right off, that's one advantage that even a decade or two ago, homeschoolers didn't have, homeschooling kids. So it's easier than ever for kids to find information. I think also kids have always, you know, we tend to denigrate screens and television and so on and so forth. But I think in hunter-gatherer cultures, kids can see what all the adults are doing in the band. They know what everybody does. Right. And so you don't have to provide any special, hunter-gatherers don't have to do anything special to make sure that the kids will be exposed to all those things in the band. We can't we can't, unschooling doesn't just mean that you're turning your kids out onto the street, you know, and then expecting them to become educated. They're going to learn whatever it is that's on the street, and we may or may not want them to learn just that. So we need to be able to, if we want our kids to grow up with options and the option of sort of entering mainstream world and doing well in this world economically as well as in every other way, we need to expose them to kind of what's best in the culture. We need to expose them to people who behave morally, we need to expose them to people who talk about ideas. We need to expose them to, to people who are literate, to people who are numerate, and so on and so forth. Ideally, that exposure occurs largely through interaction with other kids, not with adults. Children are very much designed to learn from other kids. And as I pointed out, in hunter-gatherer cultures, the kids are always playing in age-mixed groups, and the younger children are constantly being boosted up to higher levels of activity by interactions with older children. Same thing at the Sudbury Valley School, where I did that at my initial study of the graduates. And we did observations. Subsequently, another graduate student of mine and I did a study of how of age mixed interactions at that school. And the children are interacting with one another across ages all the time. And whenever they're interacting across ages, it's a learning experience for both parties, both the older kids and the younger kids. The younger kids are learning more sophisticated ways of doing things from the older kids. They're being boosted into higher levels of activity. So for example, you might see at the school a bunch of kids around a computer screen playing some kind of a computer game that involves words on the screen, and you've got to be able to read the words on the screen to play the game. And some of the kids can read, some of the older kids can read, and some of the much younger kids can't read. And the older kids are pointing out the words. And so they are kind of teaching the younger ones to read. Or maybe they're playing a game that involves adding up scores. And the older ones get tired of adding the scores for the younger ones, so they show them how to add, And this happens all the time. And it's not just in, I'm taking reading and math as examples because these are things people are concerned about. But same thing for climbing trees, for hitting a baseball, for everything else. When you're playing across age, you have to, if you're the older kid, in order to make the game interesting, you kind of have to help out the younger kids, so that they can acquire the skills needed to play that game in a reasonable way. And the older kids in the process are learning to be caretakers, they're learning to be leaders, they're getting a sense of their own maturity, they're learning, even an 8-year-old can be the one who's the helper in relation to a 4 or 5-year-old, even a 6-year-old kid. So you get, and that's an extremely valuable feeling that I actually can help other people. I'm not always the person who needs help. I can be the person who helps other people. And to grow up with that sense of I'm a helper is very valuable. And another thing that older kids, especially teenagers in our culture, gain from interacting with younger kids is the kind of creative energy of younger kids. Teenagers in our culture tend to sometimes get a little cynical, and they think they've grown beyond, playing with crayons and blocks and and doing all these creative things, or get playing fantasy games, although they might play fantasy games on the computer. So but when they're playing with little kids, they get drawn back into those things. And so some of them become really good artists or good storytellers because the little kids are stimulating them not to go beyond, not to outgrow these creative and energetic kinds of adventures. So age mixing is good, both for the younger kids and the older kids.
Yeah, I noticed that when we started homeschooling, when we started going to like co-ops and these groups, I noticed that the older kids were really good at taking care of and working with the smaller children. I was not like that at that age. When I was, 16, 17 years old, I don't think I would have known what to do with if somebody just handed me a, you know, a small child and said, can you go entertain them? I just, it wasn't like that. Cause I had just grown up with my friends who were all the same age. And I just wasn't exposed to that except maybe some right. cousins, but that was one of the first things I noticed. And it was a, for me, it was, you notice a sign of maturity as well from that, that they right. were more mature than a lot of the other kids you saw, these homeschooling kids who were used to interacting with kids of all ages. I found that really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, it used to be back when I was a kid, which was a long time before you were a kid, age mixing was pretty common because kids were just outdoors playing most of the time. Yeah. And, you know, moms would just get out of the house. You know, you'd be your entire time when you weren't in school or at some doing chores at home, you were out of the house from about the age of 4 or 5 on through teenage years. And so you were out there playing oftentimes in age mix groups. So I often say that as a kid, I had two educations. I had school, which was not then the big deal that it is today. It was far fewer hours. There wasn't homework in elementary school. There was far more time for recess and so on and so forth. It just wasn't the big deal that it is today. But I had school, and then I had what I call a hunter-gatherer education out there, playing, exploring, doing things on my own initiative with other kids, and learning in very much the same way that hunter-gatherer kids learn. And I think that's always throughout most of human history been normal childhood. And today, unfortunately, that's not the typical childhood that we allow our children. They're spending way more time in school. And even when they're not in school, they are most frequently in adult-directed activities. So they have very little chance to learn how to initiate their own activities, to learn how to solve their own problems, to learn how to deal on their own terms with kids, with other kids, including kids who might be a little bit bullying. How do you deal with that? How do you manage that? Mm-hmm. If you've always been in a situation where some adult is always solving that problem, those problems for you. And I think we're seeing that. I think that kids are growing up today often anxious, depressed, partly because they're lacking in play. You take play away from people and they'll be anxious and depressed. And partly because they're in these competitive activities all the time. School is very competitive. And then if you're not just going out to play in your own way, which is generally non-competitive, you're now on some kind of a team where you're working for a trophy. And do you make the first team or not? Do you make the travel team? I mean, we've turned children's life into sort of one big set of competitions, and that's not natural for children. And the result of that is we're putting them in a situation where there's always some kind of sources of anxiety. And in addition, as I was starting to say, because it's all adult directed, they're not learning that they're able to solve their own problems. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe you can solve your own problems, if you believe you're always dependent on some authority figure to solve your problems for you, that sets you up for anxiety and depression. What if they're not there? What if something happens? Anything could happen at any time, and I could do nothing about it. That mental set is a mental set that is likely to lead a person to become depressed. Or the first thing that happens that is difficult to deal with, and nobody else can solve this problem, you feel you can't handle this, and therefore you feel you have a mental breakdown of some sort. And children are having mental breakdowns, and especially teenagers are having mental breakdowns at record rates today. At no time in human history have we seen so much mental disorder among teenagers as we're seeing today.
Oh, when I was reading your book, something that stood out to me was that you said most of their lives, it's basically them along with their parents, and it's mostly their parents, that they're trying to build this resume. Everything that they do is a resume builder so that one day they can be a successful person. And right. you do see that. I even saw that growing up. It was, if the resume isn't perfect, if I don't have the 4.0 GPA, if I don't go to the exact right school, if I don't, you know, right. I'm not a captain on the, you know, whatever team, then something went wrong and my life doesn't doesn't play out like this perfect script, that there's a problem. And yeah, I think that's a major issue, because when something does go wrong in life, and the other problem is too, that nobody's allowed to fail. And right. like you said, if you're not allowed to fail, one day when the person who's always been there that never allowed you to fail isn't there anymore, there's going to be a big issue. And that ends up being, you know, a mental breakdown.
Exactly. And the interesting thing, we now live in a world where, you know, you increasingly, you almost have to be an entrepreneur of some sort to make a living. You've got, you know, we don't have union jobs that you can stick to the same job your whole life. You're going to have to go from one job to another. You're going to have to find ways to make your own living. And you are going to fail. You're going to fail multiple times. Yep. And if you haven't had any experience with failure, you're even afraid to try something at which you might fail. And we're seeing that employers who are hiring young people, who are hiring young adults, are finding, are reporting that increasingly they're finding that the people they hire want to be told exactly what to do rather than to have to figure it out themselves, because they might, you know, they'll say, you know, I hired this person to solve these problems, and now the person wants me to tell them how to solve the problem. I wouldn't have hired him if I knew how to solve the problem. You know, so that's the you know, that. And similarly, we're seeing I'm retired from teaching in college, but and have been for some time, but already was beginning to happen even when I was teaching, and it's happening more and more now. What I hear from professors and from the counselors in colleges, and there's actually quite a lot written about this now, is students are having mental breakdowns, literally mental breakdowns, about something like getting a B in a course. Mm-hmm. They've always gotten A's. I can't get less than an A. I'm a failure. I'll be homeless. I'll be, you know, that's what seems to go through their mind. You know, they just, you know, what, how awful that is. We used to have, when I was in college, we had this concept of the gentlemanly C. A C was just fine. No longer.
my mom's a retired professor too. And she said the same thing. I remember she was just like, I cannot believe that these, you know, they're considered young adults are falling apart over what I consider to be a perfectly fine grade. But if it's not that A, she said the same thing. She's like, they were right. falling apart. Then they were having their parents email her. And like you said, they right. don't have that. They don't know how to cope without their parents or whatever adults that they always relied on in their life. They don't have those coping skills.
Right. There's actually an interesting book on this written by a woman named Julie Lithcott Haynes, who was the dean of freshmen at Stanford University. And she observed this so often. She observed, so here are these bright kids, you've got to be bright to get into Stanford, who were just unable to deal with the bumps in the road of life. And she saw that over and over again. And she says in the book that it changed the way she was raising her own daughter. She began to pay much less attention to how she was doing in school. It doesn't matter how you're doing in school, and more attention to letting this daughter have free time, letting the daughter. And also the other thing she said is, you know, there's all these kids who've been, you know, their parents have put so much emphasis on their academic development that they haven't really asked them to do chores around the house. So there's all these kids who don't know how to make their own bed, you know, who don't know how to cook. You know, increasingly we're producing adults who don't know how to take care of themselves. And so she said, so I began to, you know, I stopped enforcing academic work and started enforcing chores around the house. I thought that was a good direction.
That's a great example. I'm in the military and I deal with a lot of young adults that are coming in. And the first time I saw that, it made me stop and really, it made me realize what was going on with a certain group of people coming in. So I remember I asked this person to go do a very simple task, very simple.
Yeah.
And they came back about five times to ask me questions on it. And I said, look, you need to go figure that out. I said, it's not that hard. Yeah. And I said, there's even a book on how to do it. I said, you shouldn't have to come back to me five different times to ask. That's why I'm asking you to go do it so you can figure it out. And it made me realize that they've never been asked to accomplished anything on their own before.
Right.
So I wasn't upset. I was just a realization that, wow, we have to start really from the ground up with some of these people coming in because they just don't have those life skills.
Right. Yeah. And when you think about it, it's a lot of this has come from the lack of real play. So play by definition is always you're always figuring out what to do. You're always solving problems in play. You're creating your own activity. You're solving your own problems. And play is the most creative thing that children do. And so if you take play away from children, they're always just doing what adults are telling them to do. Then of course they're not going to learn that they can figure out how to do things. They've been raised to do what they're being told to do. They've been raised to think they're being good children if they do what they're told to do. And unfortunately, you know, at the same time that we're in a world where we need creative people and we need innovators more than ever before, because all the straightforward jobs that don't require creativity and innovation have been taken over by robots and computers, right? So we need people who can solve problems that nobody else has solved or can even think of new problems, new ways of looking at something. We also need people who have social skills. That hasn't been replaced by computers and robots yet. We need people who have moral values. But those are not the things that can be taught in school. And school is suppressing all of those things instead of allowing them to happen. Children exercise all of those things in play. You know, you learn how to care for another person even in play, because when you're playing with somebody else, if you are not caring of them, they will stop playing with you. If you bully them, if you don't pay attention to whether they're having fun or not, they will leave you. And so even social and moral capacities are being developed when children are playing freely away from adults, as well as initiative and creativity and problem solving of all sorts.
I wanted to, we've kind of touched on a little bit of this, but I wanted to bring this up because I loved it. It was a quote, a quote from your book. And just wanted you to touch on that after I read it. But you said, if you do what you are told in school, everything will work well for you. Children who buy into that message stop taking responsibility for their own education. They assume falsely that someone else has figured out what they need to do and know to become successful adults. That's how I felt in school growing up, was I'm just going through this process because this is what I was told I needed to do. And once it's all over, voila, I'm going to be on my way to success and have a great job. And I just need to follow these instructions, but we all know this is not the case.
Right.
It ends up in disaster for a lot of people because they're completely lost. But can you kind of touch on how we change that, especially, I guess, in homeschooling, what we can do?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, with homeschooling, you have this advantage. I think the real advantage of homeschooling is that you know your child and you can follow your child's lead rather than try to shape your child into something that isn't natural for your child. And school can't do that. You know, school has 30 kids in the class, maybe one teacher. No matter how wonderful that teacher is, no matter how idealistic that teacher is, there's no way that teacher can meet the needs of your child. There's just no way that teacher can understand who your child is. There's no way that your child's own curiosity can be developed in that school classroom. Because imagine if every child was allowed to follow their own curiosity with 30 kids in the classroom and the teacher's job is to keep order. Impossible. No. So in the classroom, curiosity has to be suppressed. There's just no way around it. No matter how much the teacher may say, I really love curiosity and I want to foster curiosity. She might try to make the kids curious about the things that she has to teach, but no way are they all going to be genuinely curious about it. Some of them will learn to fake curiosity, but they, you know, and so But the thing about homeschooling, you know, there's a lot of ways to do homeschooling. And the kind of homeschooling that I've been most interested in and studied is what's called unschooling, where the children themselves are the leaders of what they're learning. The children themselves, you know, the adults simply kind of facilitate whatever the child is interested in. This is the same way as would happen in a hunter-gatherer culture. The children themselves are taking the lead. But even for parents who don't buy into that totally, and they are sort of teaching a curriculum and they have certain expectations of the child learning, nevertheless, there's way more time for that child to follow their own interests. Even those people who are teaching a formal curriculum, it usually only takes a couple of hours a day. You're not sitting down for 6 hours a day with your kid. No way. You don't have the patience for that, nor does the kid. So you're just not going to do that, right? So even those parents who may sit down and every day do an hour's worth of some mix of reading and history and arithmetic or something, the rest of the time the child is pursuing their own interests. And that's where it becomes really important, I think, that the parents be able to figure out, and this is not necessarily easy to do in our culture, how do you find ways, especially as your child gets older, to connect your child to the larger world outside of your own world? How do you find ways for the child to make friends and to have kids to interact with away from your own family? You know, how do you find ways, whatever the child is interested in, how do you find ways for the child to explore that interest beyond what's possible within your own home and within what you yourself know? How do you help your child? Expand his or her interests? I think that's the real challenge. Mm-hmm. It's not teaching a curriculum. That's not the challenge of homeschooling. A lot of people, when they start homeschooling, they think, oh my God, I've got to know all these subjects, all these school subjects, and teach them. But if you think about it, you know, the 95% of what kids learn in those school subjects, they forget anyway. And also, they're really, if you really think about how much of a 6 or 7 hour school day is actually spent productively versus how much is spent just kind of, waiting in line or sitting there listening to stuff that you're not really paying attention to, or, you know, it's an awful lot of time is wasted. One of the things, you know, we did a little study of after the COVID closure of schools, we did a study of families and how they were dealing with school at home in April and May this past spring after schools were closed. And one of the things we learned quite a bit from that, actually, that all in all, more kids were less stressed as a result than they were before. So here's this big pandemic and they're less stressed. Why? Because they don't have to go to school. But those who were doing school at home through distance learning were saying things like, I can do the whole school curriculum. I can do the whole thing. And I'm doing just as much as I did in school. And it only takes me 2 hours a day.
Yep.
And I've got the rest of the time to play. Mm-hmm. So you can be much more efficient when you're doing it at home. What you're missing is interaction with other kids, but you don't really get much real interaction with other kids in school anyway, because you're not allowed to, you know, except at certain times, you're not even allowed to talk to other kids. Helping other kids is cheating, right? You know, kids naturally want to help one another. So people talk about the value of socialization, of sending your kids to school, but is it really healthy socialization where, first of all, you're only with other kids your own age, and we've already talked about the value of age mixing. Secondly, you're in a setting where you're really not allowed to interact much with those kids, except at special times. And you're in a setting where the basic human drive to be helpful to one another is shut off, because you're now in this competitive situation where everything is your individual achievement, as opposed to, you know, and if you're helpful by giving somebody else the answer to the test question, that seems helpful, but that's cheating, right? Yeah. So is that very valuable socialization? So I think it's not. And but in homeschooling, in order for kids to learn how to get along with other kids, in our society where kids aren't just naturally outdoors everywhere, the question is, how do you solve that problem? And I think that's a challenge for homeschoolers. And I think many homeschoolers meet that challenge very well, but I think it's something that anybody doing homeschooling has to think about. How am I going to, you know, I love my kids, kids love me and they're bonded with me and so on and so forth. But the reality is that kids by the age of four and beyond need to interact with more people. And how does one make that possible?
That was a big part of your book, was that we've lost something from this competitive, you know, educational system.
Right.
But do you think there's a place for that?
Yeah, but I think that we overemphasize competition. And kids can, you know, one of the things that that when kids, my experience is this, and there, if I look at the successful adults that I know in the world, and by successful adults, I mean people who are happy in life. Mm-hmm. They're also very often people who are making a reasonable living, if not a good living. They're people who, you know, they're people who, if you ask them about their life, and even you don't even have to ask them, you just see they're living a very happy life. And even some of the people who financially and in terms of how famous they are very successful people who you would think would be very competitive people. My experience is that they have achieved their success more by cooperation than competing.
Okay.
They've been very successful at cooperating with other people to achieve the ends that they want to achieve as well as what the other people want to achieve. Just to give you one example, you know, one of my best friends is a very famous biologist. He's actually the head of a major department of biology at Harvard. He's kind of sought by every university to head up their biology program. And he is the most cooperative, least competitive person I know. And why is he so successful? He's so successful partly because people like him, because he likes them. Mm-hmm. And so he attracts great researchers because they like to be with him. Mm-hmm. And they know that he will help them. And they in turn help him. So, and I don't think it's just in science. I think it's in almost every realm that's true. Now, we do know counterexamples. We know people, but I would say they're not happy people who have been economically very successful, mm-hmm. who are very, very selfish. And they have been on a line, I'm going to make as much money as I want, and I'll exploit whoever I need to exploit in order to do that. That's not my definition of success, but I want to acknowledge that one could be, in some people's eyes, successful by that route, but I don't think that's true success. One thing that I can say is, you might think that the kids growing up at Sudbury Valley or unschooled kids, because they haven't been generally in these competitive kinds of things that kids are in, you might think that they would be lacking in competition, but yet they don't seem to be lacking in ability to do well in their careers and to do well in life. They can get into college, they can do fine in college, where they do now have to, in some sense, be competitive. They have to figure out how to convince I think the way they would put it is, they're not trying to compete with other people. Their orientation is not to make other people fail, right. Not to prove themselves better than somebody else, but they're in some sense competing with themselves to get themselves into. That's a different kind of meaning of competition. I need to do better. I want to do better. And I don't think there's anything about unschooling or, in fact, in play, kids are in some sense always competing with themselves. And the reason is because they're always challenging themselves. You're all in play. You're always challenged. You're always in some ways at the cutting edge of your physical or mental ability. Otherwise it gets boring. Otherwise it's no fun. So imagine any kind of play, And whatever the kid is playing, imagine a teenager is playing a video game, for example. Why are video games so attractive? It's because they're so difficult and because there's no end to the difficulty of it. As soon as you master one level of a game, you go to a higher level of it and in order to make it more interesting. And as soon as you get to the highest level, you go to a different game. Or, you know, this is true for any kind of play. You know, the games that you can master and there's nothing else you can learn from it. Let's say tic-tac-toe, you know. Once you've figured out all the strategy of it, nobody wants to play it anymore because you can't learn anything from it. Checkers, you can go a little farther. Chess, there's no end because it always is challenging. It always is hard. You can never fully master it. I would say in every realm of play, the reason that the play is fun is because part of the reason the play is fun is because it's challenging.
I wouldn't say I'm a highly competitive person when it comes to like trying to beat other people. I guess right. That's exactly what I meant was I think there's a place for having that competition with yourself and having that
absolutely.
Mindset to, as you said, I guess they still have that even at Sudbury.
And I'm very much that way too. My wife teases me about it. I keep records of, you know, I go on 10-mile bicycle rides and I'm 76 years old and I'm still keeping records of how fast I'm doing and am I improving or not?
That's great.
It becomes a little harder to keep improving.
That's
somebody told me, a friend of mine told me, I say, as you get older and if you have that orientation, it's a good thing to take up a new sport because you can improve on the new sport.
I was going to say one of my favorite quotes I wanted to mention from your book was critical thinking is founded in creativity and creativity always requires a degree of playfulness. I love it because again, there's like this cycle that just keeps coming back to play and it amazes me. Even the creativity going back to playfulness.
Right.
And the critical thinking. I guess that's the one that really gets me is the critical thinking because everybody, we know how important it is to be able to critically think, like we mentioned earlier, and how the schools stress about it, but I feel like they're going about it the wrong way. And then with this quote, you just pointed out how it all stems from playfulness.
Right. Yeah, I think critical thinking does stem from playfulness, but it also stems from dialogue. And I think that for people who are, you know, if you want your child to be a critical thinker, the best thing you can do is to really engage in discussions with your child, and discussions with your child about things your child wants to discuss. So, if you just tell your child, you have to brush your teeth because I told you so. the child is not going to learn critical thinking that way. Mm-hmm. But if you say, you know, there's this data about about how teeth fall out later on if you haven't been keeping them clean, and you're giving them reasons. You mm-hmm. are demonstrating critical thinking and the use of evidence. And when your child tries to make an argument, you ask them, well, so why would you want to do that? Or you ask them for their reasons, not in a way that's designed to put the child down, but in a respectful way where you want to hear the child's reasons for things. So the child grows up thinking, you know, my thoughts count. And I think that's really important. Now in school, that doesn't happen or it happens very little. And again, with 30 kids in a classroom, how can they all be critical? If you're going to give a lesson and you're going to permit critical thinking about that lesson, you know, you're going to spend the whole term on one idea, which mm-hmm. might not be a bad way to spend the term, but that's not what the school system allows you to do if you're the teacher. So school is, although teachers love to say I value critical thinking, just like they love to say I value creativity, it's really not possible in school. Generally speaking, it's not possible. You know, there's a little bit you can do to foster it, but what the students learn very quickly on is that their job in school is to give the answer that you want, that the teacher wants. And that's the opposite of critical thinking. Critical thinking would be, well, you know, I really don't agree with the textbook here, or I don't really agree with what I want to know why, you know. So that kid who, which was my son, by the way, in school, that kid who asks those kinds of questions, maybe the first time it's okay, but the second time it becomes a real pest. That kid becomes a nuisance. critical thinking really requires challenging the ideas and thoughts of another person or of the textbook. It requires asking challenging questions. It requires not always agreeing. There's not really room for that in school.
No.
But there's lots of room for that at home. And so, you know, there's lots of room for that. And presumably you too engage in a certain amount of, you don't always agree, right? I mean, you don't just say to one another, because I told you so. I hope you don't say that, right?
No.
And so if you think of that same thing with your kid, you know, you can have legitimate disagreements and have discussions about it rather than take the authoritative approach, because I'm an adult and I've been around in this world longer than you have, and therefore do what I tell you to do. That's what many parents would say. And in the past, that was almost what parents were supposed to say. Mm-hmm. But if you have a more democratic family, that means that you're going to discuss these things, and that means that your child is going to grow up to be a critical thinker.
I love that. And I actually, that was one of the things I think we noticed when we also started homeschooling. I don't know if it was just because before we started homeschooling, we were both stuck in the rat race because both working full time, kids are in school and daycare. And I feel like I was just like on autopilot. But once we started homeschooling, I found that we were having more meaningful conversations. And I found that even my thinking was to sit and actually explain more when questions arose right. from our kids and not just saying the straight up answer. You've always been good about that, but even more so, I noticed this change in myself to have, like you said, an open dialogue.
Well, I feel like they ask more questions, but also we have the time, and a big part I think too is we're not as tired,
right?
You know, from the running around, so you have the energy to answer questions when sometimes you just didn't have the energy to answer questions.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And, you know, and I think the point you just made, is a good one too, that even a little child's questions can stimulate your own critical thinking.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the things that we observed in age mixed interactions when I was describing age. One of the ways that the older kids gained is if the little kids ask them questions. One of the examples I like to give was, we observed children playing chess, where there might be an older kid who's a really good chess player playing with a much younger kid. And this is always a teaching situation. The older kid is, first of all, the older kid is handicapping himself by removing some of the pieces and playing with fewer pieces. But in addition, the older kid is pointing out to the younger kid when the younger kid makes a bad move, is pointing out why that would be a bad move. And then, and the younger kid, what I often observed is the younger kid is then challenging that, or the older kid will say, well, that's not a good move. That's not that you never move your pawn from here to here, whatever they're saying. Mm-hmm. And then the younger kid would say, why? And the older kid wouldn't necessarily really know why. It was something that the older kid had learned, and through experience it bore out that would be a bad move, but really couldn't explain why. Mm-hmm. And so it would lead the older kid to think about that more deeply, and maybe even to go back and read about it, not necessarily just to tell the younger kid, because now, but now the older kid is interested. Yeah, why is that true? You know, and so, and I remember even discussions about rules at the school. So there was one case where a young child was complaining to an older child about another child who had been calling him a bad name that he didn't like to hear, had been teasing them in this way that was hurtful to the younger child. And he was complaining to the older child. And the older child said, well, why don't you make a complaint about that to the judicial committee. The school operates in this democratic way so that if you've got some complaint, you go to the judicial committee about it. And the younger child said, well, the judicial committee won't say anything about it because there's freedom of speech. and then the older kid had to think about that. So the older kid had advised going to the judicial committee, but the younger kid probably had tried this before and it didn't work, freedom of speech. And then the older kid came back a while later and he said, well, you know, there's freedom of speech, but there's also freedom for you not to be harassed.
Wow.
And so the older kid had thought, so, you know, this is the kind of concept that the Supreme Court of the United States deals with, right? But here's a couple of kids dealing with the tension between free speech on the one hand and harmful speech on the other hand. And where do you draw the line? And what do you tolerate and what do you not? This is a very fascinating philosophical kind of question, very relevant to life in a democracy. And here are these kids having this discussion about it. So that's the kind of critical thinking that can be fostered when you are willing to listen to one another and take what the other person says seriously and think about it.
Did you know that you have a park pretty much dedicated to you, like 20 minutes from where we live in Ohio? Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yes.
There's a man who owns a farm, and he turned it into an adventure park for children. And it's basically this
adventure playground. Yeah.
An adventure playground. Amazing.
Adventure playground. He built all these different rides and toys, and there's a pond and a train track with a hand operated train that they can ride around this thing on. And he has your quotes all over the place.
About free play.
About free play. And it's basically dedicated to you without actually being dedicated to you.
Yeah. He even has a spot for the parents to sit back and relax and chat and not intervene in the children at play.
Good for him. That's great. Well, thank you for telling me that. I'm duly embarrassed by it.
it's really cool. We've taken the kids there a couple times and it's all awesome. Donations too. He doesn't charge anything.
Terrific.
And the kids have a blast.
And the adults have a blast. Like we find ourselves on the equipment.
I was on there too. Yeah, she's right. he's basically an engineer. You could see that the things that he built were really cool.
Yeah. It's called Discovery Park and it's in Lodi, Ohio.
He's got a small website just so you can look to see your park.
It's really neat.
I will look it up.
Yeah, it was cool. I just wanted to let you know that. So last two questions, just real quick.
Sure.
What's your favorite book? And the only stipulation is one that a non-academic could digest if you recommended it.
Boy, that's a hard question to answer. My favorite book often depends on whatever was the last book I read. But I would say all in all, you know, Mark Twain is probably my favorite author. And Huckleberry Finn, I could say, is certainly one of my favorite books. It's the one that comes to mind right now. And, you know, Mark Twain showed an understanding of children that very few psychologists can match. So it is definitely a favorite book of mine.
Yeah, you even quoted him. I've never let school interfere with my education.
Yeah, right. Of course, you can quote Mark Twain on almost anything. You can say almost anything you want to say and attribute it to Mark Twain.
All right, last one. And this is a version of a question we ask all of our guests before we let them go. So if you knew you were going to lose your ability to communicate tomorrow, what would be the last piece of knowledge or wisdom you'd like to leave to the world? And that could be for anything.
Oh, wow.
Should have given him some time.
Yeah. Well, let me keep it in the realm of being a parent of, you know, what is it that I would say about being a parent? And I think what I would say with this, and this is not my own wisdom, this is not there's almost nothing that I have to say that is completely original, but there are others who have said this. But I think that when you become a parent, the attitude that you need to have is that a stranger has entered my house, and my job is to get to know that stranger. And my job is to help that stranger. I love that stranger. For some biological reason, I love that stranger. But it's a stranger. It's not me. You know, we say we reproduce, but we don't really reproduce. You know, we've got some mix of one person's DNA and bits of other person's DNA, but it's a whole different person. It's not you. And the goal of that goal should not be to produce another you. And the goal should, and in fact, you should not have a preconception of what that child will turn out to be. Mm-hmm. You should watch that child, get to know that child, provide the conditions in which the child can figure out who he or she wants to be, and help that child become that. And if you take that attitude, you lose a lot of the pitfalls of parenting. You no longer feel like if the child misbehaves, it's a reflection on you. Mm-hmm. It's not a reflection on you. That's the child who did that. On the other hand, if the child succeeds, if the child gets it, let's say goes to regular school and gets all A's, that's also not a reflection on you. And so you shouldn't be taking pride in that. You know, you need to divorce your own feelings from how the child does, but accept in this that you want the child to be happy. You want the child to know who he or she is, and you want to help the child become that. And if you're doing that, then feel good that you're doing a good job.
Oh, awesome.
Great place to end it.
Yes, it is.
So we want to thank you for your time. This was great, and it was a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Have a good rest of your night. We want to thank Dr. Gray for joining us today. This was such a great experience for us, being able to speak with an author of a book that has changed our lives. We also want to thank all of you for joining us today around the fire for another amazing conversation with a fascinating individual. We also wanted to say thank you to all of our listeners that have participated in our 5 minutes or less episodes. It is one of our favorite parts of doing this podcast, and we appreciate you joining this community. If you enjoy our podcast, please rate and review us on your podcast app of choice. And as always, let's light a fire they can't put out.